everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays here at WBAI 99.5 FM. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And the way you do that is by getting more and more information about yourself, about the things you go through. And today we've got something real special for you. But before we tell you about that, you want to write this down. On Wednesday, tomorrow of this week, at exactly, 1:02 a.m. and 3 seconds. Write that down, 1:02 a.m. and 3 seconds. At exactly 1:02 a.m. and 3 seconds, tomorrow, the date, it will be 010203. And the date will be 04, 05, and 06. So if you like numbers, you like to play, it'll be 01, 02, 03, 04, 05, 06 at exactly 103. I'm going to be awake celebrating this. Join me. It's like Pi Day. This won't happen again for 942 years. Hey, Armand Demel here with you. We have with us today in the studio Andrew Solomon. Now, what is an Andrew Solomon? Andrew Solomon wrote a book, must have been 10 years ago, I think. Isn't that right, Andrew? 5 years ago. 5 years ago, a book came by my desk, and I saw one of the perceptions into depression that I couldn't really believe anybody had gathered and done and researched. If there ever was an atlas of depression, The Noonday Demon, which is the title of the book, The Noonday Demon, is one. So this week we're going to focus on depression. Why? Because a lot of people are depressed. Because people are depressed, and there is so much more research and so much stuff appearing about what to do about it that we want to bring you a whole week of how to deal with depression. I'm going to start with information. First, I want to bring you my very special guest, Andrew Solomon. Andrew, welcome to WBAI.
What a pleasure to be here.
Andrew, you know, you started this. We want to make clear that Andrew is, his credential is STB PhD, which means soon to be PhD, studying for a PhD at Cambridge. So he came into this not as a physician, as most researchers are. You know, they write books about depression, and they're usually selling whatever they sell. They're usually saying, you know, and the only answer to depression is to take Prozac, and it's written by somebody who's got a contract with Prozac. Or the only answer to depression is to do this psychotherapy, and it's written by somebody who sells that psychotherapy. Not Andrew. You were interested in depression for another reason.
I became interested in depression because I had a very severe depression of my own, and I felt utterly unprepared for it and utterly bewildered by it. And as I began to come out of it, I started looking for books that would allow me to make sense of the experience I'd had. And I found that there were wonderful memoirs, and there were terrific medical texts, and there were some philosophical treatises, but there was nothing that brought it all together. There was no synthetic wisdom that brought about a kind of unified vision of depression that drew from all of those traditions. And so I wrote an article for The New Yorker, which was mostly about my own depression, but also partly research. And in the week that it came out, I had over 1,000 letters, and I decided there was a real need for a book like this, and so I set out to do it.
Let's start with your depression for a moment. This was sudden, your depression? You weren't depressed, then you became depressed, and then you got over the depression?
In retrospect, I can say that I'd had a number of minor depressive episodes earlier on, and I didn't recognize that when they happened. And then my own depression came in 1994, and it came rather gradually. At first, I just remember losing some of my energy and some of my verve and vim. And then I remember beginning to lose feelings. My first novel was being published, and I had always dreamed of publishing a novel, and it had rather good reviews, and I found I just didn't care about it. And then as time went on, the sense of everything being difficult began to come to me. So I would come home and hear the messages on my answering machine, and instead of thinking, wow, all those people called, I would think, God, that's a lot of people to have to call back. And eventually that began to escalate until it just seemed like so much effort to go outside and so difficult to function or to do anything. And I remember thinking I should have lunch and thinking, but I would have to get the food out and put it on a plate and cut it up and chew it and swallow it. And it sounded like the Stations of the Cross. I was just completely, utterly overwhelmed by everything. And people don't talk much about it, but when you're in a depression, you know that what you're experiencing is ridiculous. You know that everybody else eats lunch all the time without giving it much thought. And there you are totally overwhelmed by it. And I thought, what on earth is happening to me? And I was seeing at the time and someone who I fondly refer to as the incompetent psychoanalyst. And she said to me, well, you know, you're just having a rough time and just stick it out. And she never said, you have a severe depression and it needs to be treated. And then I began feeling anxious all the time. It was this state of being perpetually terrified and not knowing what it was that I was terrified of. It was like that feeling if you've sort of tripped and you're about to hit the ground and you feel completely powerless and completely terrified. But it went on for day after day, week after week. And frankly, if you said to me, you have to be depressed for a month, I would say, well, okay, as long as it'll be okay in May, I guess I can put up with it for a month. But if you said you have to be intensely anxious for a month, I would say I would rather die than go through that again. And finally, it just had become so painful to be alive. And I was really paralyzed. And I woke up one day, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. And I lay in bed, and I stared at the phone, thinking I should call, I should ask for help. And I almost thought I'd had a stroke, because I couldn't reach out and pick up the telephone. And finally, after about 5 hours, it rang. And I said to the person who had called, I'm in serious trouble.
The energy conservation that happens with depression is quite an experience when described from the inside, because it begins to happen. You can feel your energy is kind of going away, and you have to think about, I don't have that much left. How am I going to use it?
Yes, absolutely.
Will I use it to make a sandwich, or will I just eat it out of the container, because making the sandwich creates a new problem, you know, or even eating and digesting creates a problem.
Someone I know who had a depression said to me, I got up the other day and I opened the refrigerator and I thought the milk was going to be in the front of the top shelf and it was in the back of the top shelf, and I knew I was never going to be able to get it from the back of that. That was too much. I had mustered just enough energy to get it from the front of the top shelf. It's very gradated, and you really do have to plan for whatever little bit of energy you have.
The depression you're talking about, what you're talking about is not just a depression. At the beginning, you said there's a depression. How would you characterize the beginning depression?
Well, I would say there was...
From what you've learned.
You know, I always say the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And I think that what one loses is not a sort of so much a sense of bliss and joy, which obviously comes and goes throughout life. I think that the loss is really that you lose the basic energy and the basic motivation to stay alive. And I think people talk about, you know, why some depressed people kill themselves and some depressed people don't. It's hard to organize yourself to do anything as dramatic as kill yourself when you're really, 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 really depressed. There's just this feeling of finding everything so desperately difficult, of finding functioning so desperately difficult. But if you could commit suicide passively, if you could commit suicide by just not doing anything and giving up, we'd all be gone.
A lot of people would have just given up. Some people say that's what crib death is. You know, they say, you know, it's a form of depression from where you just kind of give it up because there's nobody around.
I hadn't heard that about crib death, but it makes very good sense.
Especially among the people who are foundlings. You know, among foundlings, who, and then they found that when the foundlings are picked up and stimulated, they had a lower rate of death among the foundlings.
That was the origin of John Bowlby's work on attachment, and the sort of important attachment work from the middle of the 20th century, was that they realized that children who were being brought up in homes, the wisdom in the 1930s and 40s was that children should be brought up in the most sterile possible environment if they didn't have their families. And so they would be brought up and they wouldn't be touched and they wouldn't be picked up. And the mortality rates were just inconceivably high. 70% of children in British asylums in that period, or British foundling homes, ended up dying. And so it became clear that human interaction, human stimulus, even if there were some germs associated with it, was much more important than sterility, if it was also emotional sterility.
My own thinking about it is that what must happen at some point is you do will yourself out. That as an infant, you look at the planet and you say, wait, what am I doing here? And you still have access to an end.
Mm.
See, whereas most people, when they become grown-up humans, they can't will themselves to death. It doesn't happen.
No, suicide is a very active enterprise. You have to really make the decision to do it and throw yourself into it. It's interesting. I feel like people talk about suicide as one of the symptoms of depression. It seems to me that suicidality is a part of some depressions and not a part of others. And I've met people whose depression sounded kind of mild, but who had the right combination of impulsiveness and anger and all of the other qualities that lead someone actually to be suicidal, and who made suicide attempts after a more mild depression. And I've met people who had the worst possible imaginable depression, but who were not suicidal. They found life agonizing, but they weren't planning ways to end their life. They run on parallel tracks.
Well, you allude to something at the beginning. When you talked about your own depression, you said you felt a loss of energy. And you feel the loss of energy down, 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 depressed, more depressed, more depressed, more depressed. And that's one thing, where you turn into a dish rag. Mm. Then comes this vitality comes into it, this energy comes into it. Now, one would imagine that there's some master controller who looks and says, oh, this human being here is losing their vitality and they're going to die, so we're going to give them a jolt of energy. And then you start getting this anxiety, which is almost like it's, if one might interpret it as, it's being fed into the body because it perceives that you're dying. And so now it gives you energy, but the energy doesn't go along with what cures the depression. It doesn't balance it. Now you have depression and energy, the hateful state of an agitated depression. And it seems that it's in the agitated depression that you get the most suicide and the most, like you said, if you have to live this way for months on end, of course you would think of ending it. I don't know if it's so much suicide, I'll kill myself, as much as it is, I wish I could quit, I wish I could stop it.
Mm, yes. There's no question. An agitated depression is, I mean, I don't want to sort of trivialize the experience of people who have passive depressions, but if you have a passive depression, you can basically just sleep a lot and keep your head under the pillow, and you feel horrible, and your entire life falls apart. But the agitated depression, you feel like you're going to explode from the anxiety. You feel like there are these forces building up inside you that are out of control and that are so agonizing that you're sitting alive in 1 minute and not thinking, well, I wonder what the trajectory of this is. Maybe I'll be better in 3 months. You're thinking, how am I going to get through the next 30 seconds? Because if I have to go on feeling this way for 30 more seconds, I don't know what I'm going to do or how I'm going to pull through it. It's so agonizing, and it feels so physical. You know, people sort of say, well, but it's all in your mind. And I feel like, look, your mind is a very physical thing anyway, but when you get into that kind of state, into an agitated state, you just feel like your entire body is much less of a sensory organ than your mind is.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Very important stuff we're talking about today. We're talking with Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. It's great reading for the families of people who are depressed, so you could understand that, as well as for those who are depressed as well. Andrew, so you talked about in your own experience, so now you had this depression, then you had an agitated depression, which was all of this anxiety getting in there. And you felt that eventually, was there a cause for the initial depression? Did you ever find a link? Did you find an incident that happened? Did somebody die?
I think in general that most people have some degree of vulnerability to depression, and that some people are very vulnerable, so they get depressed after a very small trigger, and some people are much less vulnerable, and so it takes a much bigger trigger. I think I fell somewhere in the middle. My mother had died a few years earlier. That had been very traumatic for me. Relationship that I'd been in for a long time had ended at about the same time. And it was, the novel that I was publishing was somewhat autobiographical, and I felt very exposed by the process of publishing it. I would say the real impetus was my mother's death and the difficulties that I had in handling that.
I think you make an important statement. Clearly, you're a man with great sensitivities, which I celebrate with you. I could see it in you, you know.
Thank you.
I think you're right. People who have sensitivities, people who are not that hardened, can have a wound come in, and then it kind of comes in. Now, you must have had in your life, like you, I think you wrote in your book, a series of unrecognized depressive episodes. And I think one of the things you say about that is that if you don't recognize these series of depressions, they're bound to happen again later in a bigger way. Is that true?
Yes.
Tell me about it, what you found.
Some people go through life just fine, and then they have a single episode of depression, usually with an obvious external trigger. But people who have got chronic depression, which is the case for the largest number of people who have depression at all, it will tend to be repetitive. And if you catch it early and you seek out some kind of treatment, whatever form of treatment works for you, and you get the treatment going early on, then you have a pretty good chance of turning it around before it becomes out of control. But the longer you wait and the less you do about it, the more likely it is to become utterly overwhelming and to dominate your life. So I often talk to people now who say, well, you know, I've had these kind of depressions and they've been kind of bad, but I've just managed to pull through them myself and I didn't really want to look into doing anything about them. And I feel like, no, if you've had several depressions and they've gotten each one a little worse than the previous one, do something, because the really big, horrible one is around the corner and is going to come back to you.
Where's your evidence for this? Where did you get this information? Because I know you're a great researcher. You're not talking just advising people from your own experience. Well, where did you learn that it's possible that depression, because, I mean, you could easily make a case for, well, you know, you get over it eventually and then it no longer touches you. You're saying, no, that's not true. Depression's like a mini heart attack. You know, or a mini stroke. You know, you've got a sign there's something wrong here. You get over it. Oh, here comes another one. Is a sign it's wrong. And you're saying if you don't approach it, if you don't deal with it now, it's going to grow and possibly into a kind of a really deep depression.
Well, there are hundreds of studies which show that over the course of a lifetime, depression tends to get worse. That's fairly broadly accepted wisdom in the world of psychiatry, and there are a couple of studies that have come out of the National Institutes of Mental Health, and there's some work on this that's been done by Steve Hyman, who's now at Harvard, and work that's come out of the University of Michigan and the Depression Center there. So that's been fairly broadly established. There's more recent work which has actually shown that depressions over the course of a lifetime, repeated depressive episodes, seem to cause the lesioning of some brain cells, especially in the hippocampus. And that work is also done partly at the University of Michigan and partly in Denmark at the University of Aarhus. And what it really shows is that you think that by sitting out the depressions, you're just sort of doing everything in a natural and okay way. But as with a heart attack, as you just mentioned, if you have many, many heart attacks, eventually your heart gets weaker. And if you have many, many depressive episodes, you do lose tissue in the brain. It really is having a damaging overall effect.
Well, how does depression create a lesion in the brain? Or do you think there's a lesion in the brain that's causing the depression?
No, the research has been done with imaging studies over the course of a long period of time, which show that people who have fairly normal hippocampal areas develop hippocampal lesions over a period of time. It's traumatic for the brain to go through this. It's a really ghastly thing. It's like having pneumonia over and over again will weaken your lungs. You do it over and over again, it does appear. I mean, not a vast amount of cell death, but it appears that you do have some cell death.
How do you picture it happening? I mean, let's create an image. You're laying around, you're depressed. How do you get a lesion in your brain? I mean, I can see if you don't use your muscles may become, you know, sloppy and not move and eventually. But how do you think a lesion in the brain is created from depression? Do you think it's something about the chemistry?
Yeah, depression dysregulates the levels of a variety of neurotransmitters and of other chemicals which are active in the brain, and Particularly, an agitated depression involves escalation of the levels of cortisol, which is the stress hormone, and those higher levels of cortisol don't appear to be good for the ongoing health of brain cells. And so it seems that where those higher levels of cortisol are concentrated and where levels of other neurotransmitters are reduced, that shift in chemistry can be traumatic to some of the cells of the brain.
If you're starting off with, let's say you're a cortisol junkie, and you have higher cortisol all the time. You know, you're a coffee drinker and you're somebody who loves a type A personality and you have that all the time. Then you're saying, well, that cortisol may not create the lesions in the brain. But if you're depressed, if you're a regular person and then you get depressed, is that what you're saying it happens?
Well, coffee is
with the agitated depression.
Coffee is a stimulant, but so far as I know, it doesn't actually raise cortisol levels.
I thought it did.
If it does, I don't know if anyone studied whether long-term coffee drinking has adverse effects. But I think very high levels of stress over a long period of time, even if it's externally dictated stress rather than stress that comes out of an agitated depression, has adverse effects on the brain. I think high levels of stress really cause a lot of problems.
So now we're into the brain, and let's talk about it. Roberta Atti and I have been doing research on this for years, and from what you've studied, we're looking at the brain, and here's what they're saying. They're saying, it's the serotonin. It's the dopamine. It's the cortisol. No, it's the epinephrine or the norepinephrine. What's the chemical story here? What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, that our knowledge of the chemistry is still incredibly primitive. And I think people find it comforting to think that we now know, and because the serotonin drugs have proved to be effective for many people in the treatment of depression, everyone wants to say, well, I guess the reason you have the depression is that you don't have enough serotonin in your brain. But I think that's kind of like saying aspirin, it turns out, is really effective against headaches. So the reason you have a headache is because there isn't enough aspirin in your brain. I mean, I think the raising the level of serotonin does seem to have an effect on the depression of at least a large number of people. But there is no evidence that that's because they had a low level of serotonin in the first place.
Right. There is no measurable serotonin drop that says to you this is the reason why. But if we give you a serotonin antagonist, or if we give you a serotonin agonist, we now notice that you're better. But they also recently related that to oxytocin, and they were saying that, well, what's really going on is not the serotonin, but there's some kind of bonding chemical that makes you feel even better. We don't know why it works.
It's really, I mean, the word that gets used for it is that it's a black box issue. You have the depression, you do something to it, and then it gets better. But why it's getting better, we have absolutely no idea, because we really have no idea physiologically what the depression is in the first place. And we can show certain areas of deactivation in the brain and so on, but our knowledge is unbelievably vague. We sort of, the things we seem to know least about are the inner workings of the brain and sort of far-off galaxies.
You've talked to a lot of people about this, and going through it, you must have taken a lot of chemicals. Did you?
I did.
What'd you take?
Oh, God. I mean, over the course of a long period of time, I've taken a lot of different drugs. I was originally on Zoloft and Navane, and then I subsequently took Paxil, and then I took Lexapro, and now I'm actually on a combination of Zoloft and Wellbutrin and Zyprexa. And Remeron, and I think I've taken a few others that I've left out, but it took me a long time to figure out what could really help me and to get it straight. But yeah, I've made a lot of chemical experiments here.
You've also done a lot of work with, I believe, SAMe and a number of other natural substances. What was it? What did you find with those?
The one that I now take is fish oil, which I think has been pretty clearly shown to be good for anxiety and agitated depression. My view on the natural remedies is that some of them are very effective for some people. I've met people who say that they started taking St. John's Wort and their whole life turned around and changed. And I think for the people for whom that works, it's fantastic. The concern I sometimes have is that people will try those remedies which have slightly less proven track records than some of the synthetic medications, and that they will lose a lot of time while they're waiting to see if those things work while their depressions escalate. But I found really, it's funny, I went into this as a real medical conservative, and I thought, okay, there are some medications that work. Cognitive behavioral therapy seems to show some promise. You know, the rest of this is all sort of hogwash. But I met lots of people who were helped by lots of things. And I also think, and I'm not suggesting that SAMe in particular or St. John's Wort or fish oil, all of which I think have very real effects, are placebos, but I think that the placebo effect in treating psychiatric illness is very real. Now, if you have brain cancer and you say, well, I eat a lot of honey and it makes me feel better, you may feel better, but you still have brain cancer and you'll still probably die from it. But if you have depression and you say, you know what, I have honey every morning and it makes me feel really great, then it's working, because if you feel really great, you're not depressed anymore. So it's not as though it's sort of masking an illness. Actually, you aren't ill anymore. So I've seen people respond to all kinds of things and all kinds of therapies. And my feeling now is, look, find the thing that works for you and run with it. As long as you don't get distracted by trying all kinds of obscure things while your depression is escalating to the point of you're turning suicidal.
Well, the escalation point, of course, is what... And it's not just suicide you're afraid of, is it?
It's not just suicide. It's the loss of a lot of time. I mean, I also talk to people who say, you know, I didn't want to get any help, and so I thought I'd just fight through this depression. It lasted a year, but I really got through it. And, you know, if I get another one, I'll do the same thing. And I feel like, okay... But that was the year that you were 32, and you will never be 32 again, and you will have lost that year, and your work life will probably have fallen apart, and your personal relationships will have suffered, and it will take you years to recover from the damage that was done. If you can condense your depression and have it last for a shorter period of time, your life will be more intact.
And you won't be doing that damage to your body, which is from... this depression, and it's the effect that it's having on the hippocampal area and the scarring and all the other stuff, which is what you believe.
Yes.
Yes, I know. It's kind of amazing how people who are depressed, they feel really alone. I mean, somehow in the depression is the perception that you're the only one that feels this way compared to everybody else. Do you remember that feeling?
Absolutely. And it's just so bad. You think, gosh, if other people felt like this, I would have heard more about it by now. But people are very secretive around depression, and that leads to people feeling even more alone. And also, part of the illness, I mean, one of the symptoms of it is feeling totally disconnected from other people in the rest of the world. You can't engage in the kind of dialogue that you and I are engaged in right now, which is a sort of active engagement where you think into someone else's mind. You just feel trapped in the isolation and loneliness of your own mind and body.
And how about the advice that you get from people when you do talk to them? You know, what you need to do is get out in the sunshine. What you need to do is, I mean, how do you greet that when you're in that state of depression? How does that feel?
You know, there are two parts to the answer to that. The first is that people often say to me, well, I heard my husband, wife, friend, office mate say that they were depressed and they just seemed like they wanted to be alone. And I always say, look, depression is a disease of loneliness, and it may be that it's too stressful for this person to interact with you a lot and to have a lot of engaged conversation, but don't leave them alone. If they can't tolerate having you in the room with them, then sit in the room right outside and read a book, but just let them know that you're there and that you're engaged. But the in terms of the advice people give...
So wait, let me just finish that. You're saying, I'm depressed, I need you, but I can't tell you I need you, and I can't even feel that I need you, but I need you. Now, are you saying that being somebody staying present, if you're in love with somebody who's depressed, are you saying be there for them? If they won't respond to your suggestions, if they won't go for help, be there for them, because being there for them, meaning even if you're in the next room, is going to be better than leaving them alone. They're not going to come out of it if you let them go through the bottom of it. Is that what you're saying?
I am saying that.
And yes, we're not saying it just for fear of suicide. Let's leave that one out, because that's... But they're going to hurt themselves. They're going to get worse.
And also, one of the things that gets you through a depression is the underlying knowledge that if you could only get through it, there is some value in your life on the other side.
Oh.
And if you know that you have... I mean, love does not by any means cure depression. But if you know that there are people who love and care about you... That energizes you and gives you a little bit of feeling that, God, if I can only get through this, I know it's a good life. if everyone sort of says, oh, he's really depressed, let's just leave him alone, then it's much easier for your mind to go in the direction of thinking, I don't have anyone, I don't have any life, why am I putting up with this? What is there to get out of it? And you lose some of the vitality and energy which you need. Because the other part of the answer to your question about people who sort of say, you know, get out in the sunshine and cheer up, is that I think the treatments that exist for depression help those who help themselves. That the depression is essentially needs to be fought both with external interventions and with a certain amount of your own energy driving the process.
Wherever you could get it from.
Yeah.
Wherever you can get that energy from. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break. I'll come back with some very special music. And then we're back with Andrew Solomon, author of The Noonday Demon. By now, many of you should be hitting Amazon and saying, I've got to read this. It's such a beautiful piece. We'll be back shortly.
W-B-A-I, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York, W-B-A-I.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
All by myself in the morning, all by myself in the night. I sit alone with a table and a chair, so unhappy there, playing solitaire. All by myself, I get lonely, watching the clock on the shelf. I'd love to rest my head on somebody's shoulder. I hate to grow older all by myself. I get lonely, watching the clock on the shelf. I'd love to rest my head on somebody's shoulder. I hate to grow older all by myself. I'd love to rest my head on somebody's shoulder. I hate to grow older.
The amazing Jimmy Rushing with Dave Brubeck. In case you write that down, Michael, you're going to get the calls. Jimmy Rushing with Dave Brubeck. I've been waiting for that album to be released for years on CDs. Finally came by. All by Myself, you know, is perhaps the other name for the book, The Noonday Demon.
I have to say it's the best music that has ever been played as part of a radio interview with me. You got a prize.
Thank you. Andrew Solomon. Andrew Solomon wrote this book, and I said 5 years ago it came to my attention. And I remember reading it at the time, highlighting it, looking over it, saying, wow, wow, what a contribution to people. And if we have our way during our fund drive, which will be coming up in May, Andrew will be back with us going into this a little more in depth. Andrew, let's talk about your travels and why your travels and what are your travels. Where do you live, by the way? Where are you from?
I'm originally from New York. I lived in England for a long time. I now live mostly in New York, but I go back and forth a little bit.
New York and England?
Yep.
You don't know Peter Russell, do you?
I don't. Sorry.
You will. It's great. It's a great connection. He used to work with, who did he work with? Okay, we'll get back to that. Let's talk about your travels. Now, there you are in Europe, and there you are looking for an answer to depression, and you're trying to study depression. That leads you around the world. What do you find? What are you searching for? What are you looking for?
Well, my basic idea is that people tend to think of depression as a modern Western middle-class illness. And so one of the things I wanted to do in my book was to prove that it has strong historical precedence, that depression has been around and was described by Hippocrates in ancient Greece in almost exactly the same terms we would use today, and to look at depression among the very poor, and also to look at depression in various other cultures. So I looked at depression among the Greenlandic Inuit, among survivors of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and I looked at tribal rituals for the treatment of depression in Senegal and West Africa.
What did you find?
I found that the depression itself is really quite consistent and constant. The ways people talk about it vary. The ways people treat it vary, but you really get the same underlying sensations.
Well, just for a minute, let me do this. If we talk about depression and we talk about the mood of depression, I mean, I could take you through Haiti, and in the country of Haiti, I'll give you villages and everybody's depressed. And there's depression and there's oppression, and depression is the safe way to go because there's oppression that could chop your head off as soon as you pick it up.
Hmm.
So now, you know, is there such a thing as a cultural depression, as a cultural way of where everybody's depressed?
Well, I said earlier that I thought most people had some vulnerability to depression and that it was triggered by some kind of trauma, and that for some people it only took a little trauma and for some people it took a big trauma. There are societies in which the level of trauma is unbelievably high, and in those societies the level of depression tends to be unbelievably high because everyone who had any capacity to get depressed gets depressed when there's a sort of violent, bloody, desperate revolution. I'm sure the rates of depression are very high in Iraq right now. I'm sure of it.
And among refugees of all sorts, right?
Absolutely.
Displaced, taken out of their home. One of our great contributors, Roberta Atti, isolated a thing called the refugee syndrome, which had to do with physiological responses to feeling displaced, which included all changes in the salt and the water of the body, how you would hold water as part of the refugee syndrome.
Part of the problem, however, is that once a real depression kicks in, as opposed to just responding negatively to negative circumstances, once the real depression kicks in, it's a depression, and it requires understanding and treatment as a depression. If you have a basically nice middle-class life in New York and you feel horrible all the time, you think, gee, there's something wrong. Maybe I'm depressed, and you go and find help. If you're living in a destroyed part of our society or in another destroyed society and you're miserable all the time, you think the way you feel is commensurate with your experience. But the reality is that frequently you have a depression, and your inability to handle the difficult circumstances in which you find yourself is the result of that depression, and the depression really needs to be treated in order for you to begin to cope again and to begin to rebuild your life.
I often wonder when I see refugee children, you know, in that long look on their face when they're caught out in the world, and you wonder who would even notice if they're depressed. You know, if there's a depression among the depression, you know, can the depressed get depressed? And what you're saying is yes.
Absolutely. And how well will we treat the depression? I mean, I said I did some work in Cambodia. And
let's talk about what happened there, yeah.
I met this very, very extraordinary woman, Fali Nuon, when I was in Phnom Penh. And she was someone who had been through unspeakable horrors during the Khmer Rouge period. She had had been taken by soldiers. She had been forced to watch while her oldest daughter was raped and then murdered. She had then escaped into the jungle with her two sons. One of them had died of malnutrition because there was nothing to eat. I mean, the situation was just horrible. And at the end of the war, she ended up in a refugee camp. And there were all of these women in the refugee camp who had somehow made it through the Khmer Rouge period and through these sort of times of horror in which they were pushed to their limits. And now they were just sitting in this refugee camp and they had lost their sense of any reason to be alive. And she said she would just see them. They weren't feeding themselves. They weren't taking care of their children. They weren't sort of keeping themselves clean. They were all... And she went to the workers in the refugee camp and said, what are we going to do about these women? And the workers said, look, we have enough on our hands with infectious illnesses, which is what we're trying to control here. Said psychiatric health, you know, is outside of our ken. And so she eventually, she said, she came up with a three-point system to work with them. She said, I needed to teach them several things. She said, first, I tried to give each of them some kind of work to do so they would have a purpose in the day. Some of them would never be able to do anything besides clean a house. Some of them could do various handicrafts. Some of them could do much more, she said. But I started to try to teach each of them something so that they would be able to work. And after I had taught them to work, I taught them to take care of themselves in other ways, she said, which were very, very important, she said. And then, she said, I taught them to forget, she said. And because even though they would never really forget the horrible things that had happened to them, if they could think about new things and new experiences that they were having much of the time instead, it wouldn't be the only thing in their minds and the only thing in their thoughts. She said, and then I taught them to do manicures and pedicures. And I said, you taught them to do what? And she said, I wanted them to learn to trust each other again, and they had lost the ability to trust in this period when half the country had turned against the other half of the country, she said, and I would invite them into my little hut, and I would fill it with steam, and these women who had not for many years had a chance to feel beautiful would feel beautiful, and they would hold out their hands and feet to each other and allow someone else to address them with these sharp implements that were used in manicures and pedicures, she said. And so bit by bit, as they did that, they began to talk to each other and they learned to trust, she said. And then finally I had to show them that learning to work, learning to forget, and learning to trust were not three separate skills, but three parts of a single way of being in the world. And when they understood that, then they were ready to go on. And I met some of the women whom she had treated in this way who said, she saved my life. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for her and if it weren't for those attempts that she made. So it wasn't what we would think of as conventional Western psychoanalytic-based psychotherapy or sort of any of these things. But she said that she had done this work. And the women who she worked with all were so besotted with her that they wanted to stay on and to sort of be engaged with her in some way. And she wasn't quite sure what to do with them, and so she set up an orphanage, which is called the Future Light Orphanage in Phnom Penh. And the women who she helped in these refugee camps are now the staff of the orphanage.
Hmm. Beautiful. The let's talk about the talking cure for a moment, okay? Let's talk about the thought that there are no medications and you go see a shrink. And the therapist looks at you and try something. Looks, you go to the therapist for depression and you say to the depression, I want treatment without medication. I want to get better without medication. What do you think the odds are? What do you find happening? What do you see with, for example, your psychoanalyst who is the useless psychoanalyst who just talked to you? That's one method. How many methods have you explored?
Oh, I explored quite a lot to deal with my own depression initially, and I explored a lot more when I was writing the book. I think there are some people whose depression is very responsive to the talking cure, and there are some people whose depression isn't. The popular perception seems to be, oh, if your depression occurred randomly, it must be a chemical depression, and therefore it needs to be treated with drugs. And if your depression was triggered by external circumstances, then it's a psychological depression, and it should be treated with talking therapy. I don't think that actually the source of the depression should dictate the treatment. Depression is depression, and once you have it, there's a variety of treatments, and you can try various ones. And even if your depression is apparently chemical, sometimes the talking cure will work. And certainly, sometimes, even if there have been triggering circumstances, the medications will work. I myself tend to think that the most successful strategy is a combination of those. I mean, I think you start off when you have a depression by trying to normalize your sleep patterns, because I think a lot of depression has to do with exhaustion. And I think you try to exercise, because exercise is a very effective stratagem, especially against anxiety. And you put it, there are a number of other things to put into place. And then I think the standard thing is to try something of a talking cure, and then possibly to try medication if you need that as well, or to explore other avenues. But I think if you've had a depression, who you are has changed. You're no longer the person who you were, and you need to develop an appreciation for yourself as a person who has experienced depression, and to integrate the understanding of that depression into your own character and personality. And I think talking treatments are the best way to do that. And there is real evidence that some of them, especially cognitive behavioral and interpersonal therapies, can be very effective.
Those are two. Have you done any of the more dynamics, the bioenergetics, the intense gestalt, even primal therapies? Have you gone in any of those directions?
I've tried some of those briefly. I can't say that I've done them on a long-term basis, because really by the time I got to looking at those, my depression was fairly well controlled. But I think they can be amazing. I did do EMDR, which is an intensive and dynamic therapy, and I thought that it sounded sort of kitschy and strange. It involves having rapid alternating stimulation to your left and right ear through sound, or your left and right eye through light, and it's supposed to help integrate the two halves of your brain. I found that very powerful.
Very powerful. We've worked a lot with intense feelings, dynamic stuff, and we find always the connection between anger and depression. Now, that's an interesting thing. Almost most of the theory is that anger turned inward is depression. So you either have a choice. You're either angry or depressed, because most depressed people are not able to get angry and express anger. So what we've done, and over my 30 years, what I've found is if we could get people to identify anger, even sometimes to mimic it by hitting pillows or yelling or raising their voice, that we frequently will have a very high percentage of recovery. Because what happens is when a person starts becoming aggressive again, even just in a therapy session, their chemistry changes.
Mm.
And it creates a chemical change inside their bodies in a natural kind of way. This is my belief. In fact, there's a good article on it on my webpage, The Positive Mind, called The Intense Feeling Process. But I also see everything else that you're saying. I also see some of those immovable depressions that just don't budge.
Mm.
And I also see how to look at it from so many different eyes. In your travels, when you were going, I mean, you did that. Were there any other experiences with cultures that shed any light on your...
Well, I'll tell you a story, part of which is in the book and part of which isn't, which is that I had heard about tribal rituals for the treatment of depression in West Africa, and so I went to Senegal to look at them, and there was a ritual called the Undop, and a friend's girlfriend was Senegalese, and she had set me up with a friend of a cousin of her mother's best sister. It was a long line of connections with someone who actually performed the Undop. And so I went off to interview this woman and to find out more about the ritual, and we had an interview for about an hour. It was extremely interesting, and at the end of it, I said to this woman, look, I would love to see one of these Undops actually being performed. Is that possible? And she said, well, I've never had a foreigner, a Tubob, to do it before. She said, yes, you seem very serious. She said, I think that would be okay. And I said, that's great. I said, when will you next be doing one? And she said, oh, sometime in the next 6 months. And I said, 6 months is kind of a long time for me to stay here in Rufisque, Senegal, waiting for someone to need one. Is there any way we could expedite one and have one happen sooner? And she said, no, not really. That's just not the way it works. And I said, oh, well, that's really disappointing. And I was getting ready to leave. And she said, I hope you won't mind my saying this. She said, but you don't look that great yourself. And I said, oh, really? And she said, I mean, I've certainly never done this for a Tubob before, but if you want, I could do an end up for you.
A Tubob?
Tubob is a foreigner.
Foreigner, okay.
She said, I could do an end up for you. And I said, wow. I said, well, yeah, sure. Okay. So we sort of set it up, and we walked out, and my translator said to me, do you have any idea what you're getting yourself into? And I said, well, I think it was. She said, this is magic. She said, this is... Anyway, a couple of days of preparation, a big ritual, and then a day of stuff to be done afterwards. But the day of the ritual, I won't take you through the whole thing, but I'll tell you that the high point came when I was in the central square of this little town in a makeshift wedding bed with a ram. And there was the entire village dancing in concentric circles around us, throwing sheets of fabric over me and the ram. And at a certain key moment, all the fabric was pulled off. I was yanked to my feet. The loincloth, which was all that I was wearing, was pulled off. The ram's throat was slit, and I was covered in the blood of the freshly slaughtered ram.
That'll get you out of your depression.
It was, exactly. It was a far cry from Upper West Side therapy. So, but then I had this interesting conversation, and this is the bit that isn't in the book because it happened after the book was out, with someone from Rwanda a few months later, and he said, you know, we have a ritual in Rwanda. It's not quite like that, but it's a little like that. And he said, you've described it. He said, you know, we had some real problems with Western mental health workers who came in after the atrocities here. And I said, well, why? I said, what happened? He said, we just had people who were doing very destructive things, and we had to ask them to leave. He said, okay, they did not take people into the sunshine, which is obviously an important part of getting better. They did not get the entire community involved in acknowledging that there was a problem and taking the day off from their work in the fields to focus on helping that problem. There was no drumming or music to sort of get somebody's blood flowing. He said they did this bizarre thing. They took people one at a time into kind of dingy rooms and asked them to sit there for an hour and talk about bad things that had happened to them. He said, I mean, it was so destructive. So that was a lesson in cultural relativism. What makes sense to us doesn't make sense to them, and vice versa.
That's great. My guest is Andrew Solomon, the book The Noonday Demon. Let me ask you something about this again, Andrew. You mentioned sunshine. Los Angeles is not famous for treatment, whereas New York has a lot of treatment. Florida, you have very few treatments compared to New York. Sunshine clearly seems to keep the devil away, or something about it. Do you find that there is less depression in the warmer climates in the Caribbean than there is up north? Do you find that difference?
That was what I thought before I began on this work. Over time, I've seen that the way people acknowledge the depression is different. People in Scandinavia are quite proud of their depression. When my book came out in Finnish, I was on the big Finnish morning breakfast program, and the first question I was asked on TV was, what would an American have to tell Finns about depression?
Right, okay.
Because they sort of so take it as their cultural right. When I was in
Spain. But they also have the big thing with the light. They
yes.
They have disappearing light
for long
periods.
They have that long, dark winter.
So, I mean, if anybody, alcoholism, depression, and suicide in the Scandinavian countries seems to be the highest.
But interestingly, the highest per capita consumption of antidepressants is in France. And when I was in Spain, when the Spanish edition of the book came out, I was amazed by how many people in Spain were calling into radio programs, were writing to me, were sort of interacting with me about it. I think that there's a lot of depression in Mediterranean climates, but it's acknowledged less. I do think, however, that darkness, it's not so much that sunshine makes people happy, but darkness makes people unhappy. And so I think people who live in climates where there's a dark period in the winter, that pushes a lot of people into depression, seasonal depression.
If you're in love with somebody who is, and you love somebody who is frequently depressed, are you saying try to bring light into their life?
Yes. I think bring light into their life. Try to see whether they respond to light therapy. There are lots of people who use a light box or who wear one of these visors that has lights in it for an hour every day, and it makes a real difference. And I think also, I mean, I know it's not something everybody is able to do, but if you tend to get depressed in the winter, try to schedule a week of vacation in someplace sunny in the middle of the winter. It can give you the strength to get through the rest of the season.
My guest, Andrew Solomon, the book, The Noonday Demon. Andrew, television. I want to talk about television watching and the addiction of the television watching and how many people are watching television. And if you're depressed and TV is there, it seems to be a contributing factor. You know, you never turn it off. It's almost like you have company. It's like it helps you sustain your depression longer. Any evidence for that you've seen or any thinking about that?
There are a few pieces to that. One is that the average American sleeps 2 hours less than he did before the invention of television. And as I said earlier, I think the fact that we have a chronically underslept society is one of the main reasons we have so much more depression. But the other thing is that I think interacting with machines instead of people is very dehumanizing. And I think what the television is essentially is something which projects all of this language at you and all of these images, but which never takes any notice at all of you. And so there's no exchange. If you're dealing with a person, even with a grumpy, withdrawn, difficult person with whom you're having an argument, there's still the sense that what you do has an effect on someone else, and that makes you feel alive. If you're in isolation and it's just you and a television, it just keeps going on and on at you, and nothing you do except press the remote control has any effect on what's happening up on the screen. And I think that I think it's dehumanizing, and I think people's interactions increasingly with televisions, with computers, with automated telephone systems, with all of these other things, I think that they really are very, very much contributing to the levels of depression. I think they're contributing to people's sense of aloneness and loneliness.
Well, on the other hand, we have text messaging and cell phones, which are bringing people closer by contact. Do you think that that's helping then, on the other hand? Not all machines are bad.
Not all machines are bad. No, that's absolutely true.
But some of them do work
at isolating
you. And there's something about the chemistry of machines, too, that affects people in ways that I'm sure we've yet to learn. Well, we could go on for a very long time. I find this fascinating. The name of the book is The Noonday Demon. We're going to hope to get Andrew Solomon back with us again. If you want to learn more about it, there is a website called noondaydemon.com, NoondayDemon, DEMON.com. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Tomorrow we'll have Roberta Atti with us. And we're going to be talking a little more about depression and the origins of depression. You know, we were curious about where it came from. You know, where was it born? Why did it even start? Why would the humans have developed depression as part of their system? So we're doing some research on it now. We'll bring that to you tomorrow. I'm sure if Andrew were here, he would want to. Are you going to be around tomorrow?
No, I'm not. I wish I were.
We'd have you join in on that one. So I will be back with you tomorrow, my friends. The new webpage has been launched. And if you want to see the faces of some of the folks you know, go to thepositivemind.com, and you could get all of our archives there. My special thanks again to you, Andrew. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.
Thank you so much.